Physicians, let's talk about your strategy for those DEA MEAT requirements. Every prescriber needs to complete 8 hours of training on pain management and substance use disorders. Here's the good news. NHM Group has a free online course, Pain Management and Opioids Adaptive Learning. It not only checks the DEA box, but also gives you 10.25 CME credits and ABIM MOC points. The format is case-based, adaptive, so it feels like you're working through real patient scenarios, not just clicking through slides. And you can stop, pick it up at any time on your own schedule. So instead of scrambling, get it done with something engaging designed by the NHM Group and with the same rigor you trust your clinical updates. It's free, online, certificate ready. We'll link it in the show notes. It's cme-info.nejm.org/coreim. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Marty Fried, a general internist and addiction doc at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Today, we're back with Hypercoagulability Part 2, The Clot Thickens.
That's right. We're back with even more clot-related nuance and questionable puns.
Hey.
I'm Sam, a hem-onc and palliative fellow at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Mass. In our last episode, we focused on hypercoagulability testing. Or rather, lots of reasons not to test, along with a few reasons to maybe test.
But this time, we're going to get our hands dirty. We're focusing on management today, and we're not alone. And just like last episode, we're joined by Dr. Rebecca Karp-Leaf and Dr. Jean Connors, who hail from some incredible institutions around Boston.
So hi, everybody. My name is Rebecca Karp-Leaf, and I am a classical hematologist. I am on staff at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
I'm Jean Connors. I'm a hematologist, an adult hematologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
We are also joined by our very own Dr. Ken Bauer from the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. If you haven't listened to Hypercoagulability Part 1, listen to that first. It provides the foundation for today's episode. And once you've got that under your belt, join us for some high-yield pearls about clot management. Are we ready? Try quizzing yourself on the following pearls. Remember, the more you test yourself, the more learning you'll get out of this.
Pearl 1. Managing the higher risk provoked clots, the provoked clots with irreversible risk factors.
As a reminder from episode 1, we're calling these clots provoked irreversible for short. So how long do we anticoagulate for these? Are we really treating them like unprovoked clots indefinitely? Can we ever de-escalate therapy?
Pearl 2, managing provoked reversible clots. These are the provoked clots with reversible risk factors.
These clots have a lower risk for recurrence, so we usually treat these short-term. But when and how do you decide to stop?
Pearl 3, anticoagulant failure.
When do we step it up?
And Pearl 4, the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome.
The wild card, the exception to everything we've talked about so far. This is a do-not-miss diagnosis. And that's it for the episode.
Now, usually our episodes have 5 pearls. That's the name of the segment, you know. But these are pretty hefty pearls we've got here, and we're covering quite a bit of ground with just the 4.
You won't miss that last pearl, promise.
All right, let's dive in. It's clot busting time. So, clot management. You think it's a no-brainer, right? Just treat the clot.
You'd think, but the devil's in the details. How long do we treat? What dose? What else do we think about?
So the traditional teaching is 3 to 6 months of anticoagulation therapy for a quote-unquote provoked clot. And then we talk about indefinite anticoagulation for a quote-unquote unprovoked clot.
But it's not as simple as provoked or unprovoked, is it? Quick throwback to episode 1. Whenever you see a provoked clot, think to yourself, is that provoked risk factor reversible?
So a provoked reversible risk factor, like after surgery, is generally treated short-term. A provoked but irreversible risk factor, let's say an incurable cancer, or that Crohn's is probably not going to go away for most people, it's often treated like an unprovoked clot. We treat this with long-term anticoagulation.
Still, it's not so simple. Even with this framework, theoretically, you'd treat unprovoked and provoked irreversible clots the same, with lifelong anticoagulation. But in practice, we don't always do that. So the question is, why not?
To get to the bottom of it, let's walk through a couple cases.
Totally. We're going to talk through three cases which, by the book, could all be managed the same way, but they won't be. And by the end, dear listener, you will understand why. Let's start with a softball case, the classic. You've got a 60-year-old woman with metastatic pancreatic cancer on palliative chemotherapy, and she develops a clot in her superior mesenteric vein.
All right, this is totally not reversible. Her cancer is the provoking factor, and unfortunately for this person, the risk factor is probably never going to go away. So she's on lifelong anticoagulation for sure.
Roger that. And by the way, DOACs work just fine in cancer-associated clots, even though enoxaparin was the prior standard of care.
All right, that wasn't so bad. Let's move on to case two.
Yeah, let's try the other end of the spectrum. Let's say she's still 60, but this time, no cancer history, totally healthy. She gets a CAF DVT on a 3-hour plane ride.
Ooh, okay, this is a throwback to episode one. I got this. We learned that the data for travel-associated VTE is stronger after 5 to 6 hours of travel. So 3 hours just isn't enough to provoke a clot. So she's really in that unprovoked category.
But at the same time, it doesn't really feel like we should treat her like unprovoked.
Right. So for this little distal clot, I really don't want to be anticoagulating this person forever.
Maybe another way to think about management is, how risky would it be to not anticoagulate forever? What's her risk of recurrence?
There's pretty solid data that the recurrence risk after, let's say, an unprovoked proximal DVT is, you know, plus or minus 10% in the first year and 25% at 4 years and 35 to 40% out to 10 years, if you will. The risk of a distal DVT is half of that.
So basically, a distal clot, aka clot below the knee, has half the recurrence risk of a proximal clot. That does make me feel a little better. And if we follow Dr. Bauer's numbers here, in 1 year, 5% of people might have a recurrence of their CAF DVT, but it's also, you know, a CAF DVT.
Yeah, and I guess that validates my instincts, actually. It sounds like the takeaway here is, for unprovoked clots that are clinically low risk, like the distal location here, it's probably very reasonable to anticoagulate just for the short term.
Totally. And right here, you see the discrepancy, right? Case one, our patient with cancer, is provoked irreversible and is treated for the rest of her life. Case two, distal DVT after a little plane time, is unprovoked, but is treated short term. And why are these two treated differently? The devil's in the details, right? It all depends on two risks. Number one, how clinically risky the clot itself is. And number two, the recurrence risk. And as we've just heard, the data shows us that a distal DVT just isn't as risky in either sense.
So when we're thinking about clinical risk assessment, mostly we're looking at where that clot is and how much of it we're talking about.
That's right.
All right, so let's use that risky risk framework in the third case.
All right, third case, let's go. Let's say she's still 60. This time, she doesn't have cancer. She's actually immobilized after a spinal cord injury. And
DOAC forever.
Well, hold on a second here. I wasn't done yet. And let's say she's got a little chronic GI bleeding. Some AVMs no one's been able to zap, maybe.
Okay, so this one you got me a little bit. I no longer want to DOAC forever. I'm legitimately stuck. You either continue the blood thinner or you don't. It seems like those are my two options.
What if we said there was a middle ground?
Wait a minute, but how? Anticoagulation is sort of a binary thing. You either are anticoagulated or you're not.
So there's a secret third option. Half dose, indefinite DOAC.
Wait a minute. Is this like AFib? Because in AFib, we know we can use dose-reduced apixaban if your patient has two of the three following categories, you know, age older than 80 years, weight less than 60 kilograms, or a creatinine of greater than or equal to 1.5.
Well, that's true, but the situation is a little different because you're still giving your patients the initial 3 to 6 months of full-dose treatment for VTE. But then after, you can dose-reduce your DOAC for secondary VTE prophylaxis.
Ooh, qué interesante. Tell me a little bit more about this dose-reduced trickery.
This is thanks to two international randomized clinical trials. These trials both looked at what you do after you complete initial clot treatment. Amplify Extend, the first trial, looked at continuing low-dose apixaban, 2.5 BID. And Einstein Choice, the other trial, did the same thing with low-dose rivaroxaban, 10 milligrams daily. And both these trials found that the half-dose blood thinner did just as well at reducing clot recurrence as full-dose blood thinner long-term.
There was a slight reduction in bleeding risk in the patients who were on the 2.5 versus the 5 milligrams BID. And actually, the rate of bleeding on the 2.5 milligrams BID was actually about equivalent to placebo in this study, sort of implying that, you know, apixaban 2.5 milligrams BID really is a safe drug from a bleeding risk perspective.
Wow, that's really something. To see that the bleeding risk of a half-dose blood thinner is not significantly different from placebo, kind of great news. And it's helpful that Amplify Extend looked at a broad set of patients. Basically, the folks who had sticky situations where you could make a good argument to either continue or stop anticoagulation.
And our case certainly is one of those, right? We have a 60-year-old woman with a provoked but non-modifiable DVT. So on one hand, we'd want to anticoagulate indefinitely. But on the other hand, she's a bleeder, so we could argue to stop after a short course of anticoagulation.
Totally.
All right. Mind is officially blown. I am curious, though, how does a hematologist apply this in practice? I mean, even if the trials included a broad selection of patients, who should we be thinking about for dose-reduced candidates?
I don't know that one size sort of fits all for patients. If someone is young, they have normal kidney function, normal liver function, they're doing well, they had a large clot, I typically will keep them on full-dose anticoagulation. If somebody had a clot that wasn't completely idiopathic, or especially if they're older, we do know that older patients metabolize the DOACs less rapidly, it clears less rapidly than patients who are younger, I have a very low threshold to reduce the dose.
One gap in these two trials is neither of them had very many cancer patients. So initially, we didn't know if this strategy applied safely to the malignancy population. But good thing that just changed. There was a trial published this March, the APICAT trial, which looked specifically at patients with active cancer. And just like Amplify Extend and Einstein Choice, this APICAT found dose-reduced apixaban was not inferior to full-dose apixaban in preventing clot recurrence. It also found a reduction in its composite bleeding outcome compared to the full dose.
So we can use this strategy in cancer patients. That is definitely good to know. I still am probably going to be asking a hematologist for help, but for now, it really does seem like these trials give us a reason to think about dose reducing as a viable option.
There's a lot of nuance in these cases, and we kind of just want you to be aware of dose reduction as an option. But just remember, you're not alone in making these decisions.
I do feel comforted by that warm, fuzzy blanket of a heme consult here. All right, Sam, let's wrap up these cases into some practical take-home points. So the duration of treatment really depends on two risk factors. How risky is the clot itself? And for that, we think about size and location. And then what is the risk of recurrence of that clot? The old risky risk framework. And we've got three options for the truly unprovoked or irreversible clot. First, anticoagulate forever. This is the traditional teaching. And this is for really that high-risk patient, like a patient with metastatic cancer, where the risk is never going away. Option two, we could anticoagulate short-term. This is for patients with the lowest risk clot, like distal DVTs. The risk of harm is low, and the risk of recurrence is also low. Remember that distal DVTs have half the recurrence rate of proximal ones. And finally, third option, anticoagulate short-term, and then continue long-term dose-reduced DOAC. This is for the patient who clearly has a high risk of recurrent clot, but is also maybe older or has a high bleeding risk, or maybe has poor kidney or liver function. Consider this one together with your local friendly hematologist.
All right, now let's move on to the other bucket of clots, the clearly provoked reversible clots.
All right, Sam, we're finally catching a break here. We got an easy one.
Provoked reversible clots are kind of nice like that. Short-term anticoagulation and you're done.
Bada bing, bada boom. But the question that I have is, what counts as short-term anticoagulation? Some people say 3 months, some people say 6 months. Is there anyone splitting the difference here with that rare 4.5 month anticoagulation?
Studies haven't really shown any different outcomes in 3 versus 6. I'll often go 6 for a first major proximal DVT or pulmonary embolism and then decide where they need long-term therapy. But some people might make that decision at 3. As I say, the evidence is 3 is as good as 6 months for that initial treatment.
Kind of interesting that 3 months, 6 months, it doesn't seem to make a difference.
I have seen some practice variation around here. I think the takeaway here is, while the evidence doesn't show much of a difference overall, some hematologists like Dr. Bauer will prefer 6 months for a big clot and 3 months for a smaller clot, like a distal DVT.
So you might not want to stop at 3 months if people still have significant swelling and have not yet had clot resolution. And it's kind of interesting because, remember, anticoagulants do not dissolve clots. They prevent clot propagation. They prevent them from getting bigger. And you actually have to allow, you know, natural fibrinolysis, activation of plasminogen to plasmin, to dissolve the clot.
And that adds another layer to the logic. This is kind of why the 3 versus 6 month debate probably doesn't make a huge difference overall. It's because that high risk period is really the initial 6 or so weeks where you have the highest risk of a clot propagating. And after that, it's a little bit less critical. Of course, like Dr. Connors says, if your patient's still having symptoms at 3 months, that's different. And I think most clinicians would not be inclined to stop at that point.
You know, one thing I've always wondered is, how about that plane travel situation? You know, not the 3-hour flight, but let's say someone really got a DVT after a 12-hour flight, and now they're planning on getting on a plane again and worried about that provoking factor coming back again. I've heard people pop in a rivaroxaban or maybe giving themselves an enoxaparin shot before a flight if they've had a clot before, but I'm not sure that's exactly data-driven.
There are no data. There will never be any data for DOACs for travel prophylaxis. I harassed the people who wrote the ASH VTE treatment guidelines when they came out in 2018 and said, guys, this is a perfect opportunity to give guidance on using DOACs for air travel prophylaxis. They're like, well, we couldn't because there's no data. I said, but you all do it. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay. So sometimes what the data say and what we do are not congruent.
Okay, good to know. I liked how one of our peer reviewers put it. We're basically just negotiating what feels right to our patients. Practice is all over the place.
I'm not a huge believer in prophylactic Lovenox, a single dose. Sometimes the question comes up, putting them on DOAX. I sometimes say I think these are more anxiolytic than knowing what I'm doing. But, you know, I have to work with patients and come up with the best solutions for them for these kind of things, especially if they're not on long-term therapy, if they're really flying back to Asia or something like that. It's not unreasonable to prophylax them.
All right. So it sounds like there is a healthy amount of practice variation here, too. Good to know.
Wow, that pearl really flew by. Let's summarize what we talked about. Key point here is the management of the provoked reversible clot is subject to some of that practice variation, more than you'd think. About duration, studies haven't really shown a difference between 3 or 6 months of anticoagulation to start, and so that comes down to the clinician. Some hematologists might favor 6 months for bigger clots and 3 months for smaller ones. About travel. When thinking about clots provoked by travel, the idea of travel prophylaxis often comes up. And there's huge variation here, too, in the absence of any data to guide it. Some hematologists really don't support it, while others leave it open to a risk-benefit conversation with their patients.
All right, everyone, we've covered a lot of ground, and there are lots of therapeutic approaches. Let's move on to what happens next when anticoagulants fail.
Oh, yes, the dreaded DOAC failure. Join us in the next Pearl for a chat about it, as well as some assorted tips and tricks.
Here at Quorium, we're all about the real things that help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I can't remember a time when I have seen someone in FIGS and not looking put together. FIGS scrubs are made specifically for doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals like us. We're putting in long hours and we need gear that can keep up and perform at our level. And now it's a new year, new you, or at least a new uniform. If you're in healthcare, it's a perfect time to upgrade your scrubs to FIGS. They're lightweight, durable, super functional.
antimicrobial, and ridiculously soft. You have so much going on in any shift, your scrubs are the last thing you want to think about. Plus, with the new limited edition colors, styles, Figs is putting the fresh in the uniform refresh. Scrubs, outerwear, footwear, accessories, and more. You'll be looking sharp, feeling good, and ready to take on anything. 2026 is here, and so let's do this. Take 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
All right. So here we're talking about anticoagulation failure.
Yeah, let's get into it. I feel like we're usually talking about DOAC failure, you know? Lovely 80-year-old on a apixaban as another calf DBT. And you were really trying not to escalate anything.
All right, so what do we do?
So really, underlying risk factor, why did that clot happen? The most common situation in which I see anticoagulant failure is really in widespread malignancy, especially in solid tumors that aren't responding to treatment. DOACs really are frontline treatment now for patients with malignancy-associated thrombosis, and we're all using them. It's not that apixaban is a bad drug or rivaroxaban is a bad drug. It's just we can't control these tremendous production of tissue factor.
Thinking about Virchow's triad again, the cancer could also cause direct endothelial injury or stasis if blood flow is blocked by tumor. Anticoagulants aren't really going to do anything about that mechanical risk for clot. You can throw all the DOACs you want at that, but thinning the blood is not going to completely get rid of that clot risk.
So it's not a DOAC failure per se, but either way, what do you do?
If they're on a direct oral anticoagulant, I typically will switch them to low molecular weight heparin. We do know that heparin drugs do have some anti-inflammatory effect as well.
Right. So if someone's clotting through a DOAC, we switch to a different mechanism of blood thinning. Maybe one that has a little anti-inflammatory effect like the heparins. So working up recurrent clot, I always make sure people are up to date on their cancer screenings. But what else do the experts consider?
I check patients for antiphospholipid antibodies. So if somebody has a PE and they're on a DOAC, you want to make sure that you're ruling out antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, because again, that's one of those conditions where we really don't want to use the direct oral anticoagulants.
Ah, yes. The antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, or APLAS. We're going to get into that with our next pearl, but for now, we'll say that APLAS is rare. Not everyone who clots through a DOAC needs antiphospholipid antibody testing, but it's a good thing to keep on your differential. Is the reason your patient's clotting through a DOAC is because they may have APLAS and they need warfarin instead?
Whether it's APLAS or not, whenever I get one of these consults for DOAC failure, sometimes I find the location of the clot can be a big clue. One of the things that points me to think about an underlying issue is specifically splanchnic thrombosis, meaning clots in the splanchnics, the portal vein, or mesenteric veins. These are kind of yellow flags to me. I think of things like gastric bypass surgeries, GI cancers, cirrhosis, heme malignancies, other heme conditions, all that kind of stuff.
It is a feature, particularly of the myeloproliferative disorders, to develop either Budd-Chiari, which is, you know, hepatic vein thrombosis or portal vein thrombosis, as well as I mentioned myeloproliferative disorders, as well as a rare hematologic disorder, PNH, but it can be seen even with abdominal surgery.
So basically, if you see a weird clot location, we should think about surgeries, a solid tumor in the region, or some weird hematologic thing. Probably not a bad idea to get a hematologist involved at that point, regardless.
Thinking again about our differential for DOAC failure, I always like to make sure, was it really failure to begin with?
I have given rivaroxaban the benefit of the doubt. Patients really have to take it with food. There was a small study showing that it is absorbed in the stomach and that there's better absorption with food. So let's say somebody was taking it every morning, not eating breakfast, and then they had distal DVT. I'll say, well, you weren't taking it appropriately.
It's always on my list to ask patients if they're taking their rivaroxaban with food. It's on the package insert to take it with dinner. And why is that? Because it's usually people's biggest meal with the highest fat content, meaning the most absorption.
Of course, with warfarin, you want to make sure that INR was actually therapeutic and that they have good, it's called time in therapeutic range, which means what is the percentage of time that their INR is between 2 and 3 or whatever your range is.
So if we see an INR time in range is, say, less than 60%, we start thinking that might be the issue.
But let's say we've confirmed that they were taking their meds and our patients were taking them appropriately. How do hematologists decide about switching anticoagulation therapy versus staying the course?
I think it's sort of a risk benefit with the patient. How big was the clot? How long were they off of anticoagulation for? How severe was their infection or inflammatory response that you're saying was the etiology of the failure? If it's a small clot and there's a good compelling reason why somebody may have clotted despite anticoagulation, then the patient is willing to take the risk to remain on a direct oral anticoagulant because it's so much more convenient. Then we'll have a good sort of risk benefit conversation.
So it comes down to our provoked, unprovoked discussion again. Is that risk factor for the recurrent clot reversible? If so, maybe we stay with the current drug.
Now, something we really toyed about whether to include in this episode or not was repeat labs or imaging to help with that question of DOAC failure.
And I use D-dimers more as baselines and to help me figure out if somebody has new clots. That's actually the same way I use repeat ultrasounds.
So that's pretty cool. We often think of D-dimers as these much maligned tests. We're never supposed to order them. But you'll occasionally see a hematologist order a D-dimer, and this is one reason why, to see if the clot burden is increasing. If that D-dimer is rising, it might actually push us to consider another anticoagulant.
Right, and we should say this isn't exactly an evidence-based approach. The American Society of Hematology guidelines suggest against using D-dimers. And for that matter, it also suggests against using repeat imaging and prognostic scores to guide anticoagulation duration.
But in the fine print, it does say, in the right circumstances, if there's uncertainty, I have seen the D-dimer be used as one piece of information that helps guide us one way or the other. And again, it's all about trying to get a sense of whether the amount of clot is increasing or not with your current anticoagulation strategy.
And with that, we'll wrap up our final pearl with a quick summary. First of all, confirm it's actually a DOAC failure. Rivaroxaban is going to be a problem for your patients who skip meals or maybe are NPO for other reasons. The core message here is you really want to work up anticoagulation failure like you would with any other clot. Do they have an underlying provoking risk factor that isn't being addressed? Don't forget about cancers or APLIS with recurrent clots. Do they have clots in weird vascular beds? That can be a clue about hematologic malignancies or solid tumors or prior surgeries causing issues. For example, gastric bypass has that classic association with splanchnic thrombus.
Now it's time for Pearl 4. We promised to talk about it, so here it is. It's APLIS time.
So, the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, the elephant lurking in the room.
That's right. It's APLIS. I think we're all afraid of missing this one.
Antiphospholipid antibody syndrome and its own unique beast. Patients can have a risk as high as 40% of recurrent clot at over 10 years.
Wow, that is a very high recurrence risk. And let's remember, these are some pretty morbid clots too. Strokes and other arterial clots, which can be really life-limiting.
To suspect APLIS, your patient needs to meet clinical criteria first. That said, these are pretty broad. Basically, any unexplained clot could count. That could mean a stroke, an MI, pregnancy outcomes like preeclampsia with severe features even, or any pregnancy loss before 34 weeks.
And let's just paint the picture. APLIS doesn't follow any of the rules we've talked about so far.
Here are some examples of the way APLIS can present. I've actually seen a couple of these. It's pretty humbling. For example, the patient with the unexplained arterial clot, say, acute mesenteric ischemia in a 20-year-old without any risk factors, no embolic source. Maybe it's a young person with a stroke, under age 50, or numerous miscarriages. I have seen a teenage patient permanently bedbound due to recurrent strokes despite anticoagulation. Might even be a high burden or recurrent VTE, like an extensive or saddle PE in a young patient with no risk factors, or an extensive clot recurrence in a patient who's already on a DOAC.
That is a pretty sobering list. It's a good reminder. APLIS is a bad actor.
One tiny little clue, and it's by no means perfect. If I see someone coming in with a suspicious picture, and even before starting them on anticoagulation, their PTT is elevated, even just a little bit, I think, that's odd. And it might just push me towards sending APLIS testing.
And if your spidey senses go up with any of those in a patient's history, you really should test for it. Unlike the take-home of episode 1, that was testing rarely changes your management, APLIS is the exception. Testing will definitely affect your anticoagulation strategy, heme follow-up, and counseling. Honestly, Sam, I think it makes sense to do a quick refresher on APLS testing itself.
Totally. There are three big tests we think about: anticardiolipin, beta-2 glycoprotein antibodies, and the lupus anticoagulant. Big picture, these are all tests for antibodies against different types of phospholipids, which make up our cell membranes.
Well, shoot. I was today years old when I learned that you test for the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome by looking for antibodies against phospholipids.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. Now, phospholipids are everywhere in our circulatory system, and in particular, they're all over platelets, so antibodies against phospholipids can lead to platelet activation and clot. Of these three tests, anticardiolipin and beta-2 glycoprotein are two very specific antibodies we can test for directly. And for these, we test for both the IgG and the IgM form. Doesn't really matter to us because both of them lead to clots.
Yikes. All right, those are some pretty bad dudes.
One important and really common confusion point here is that it's easy to confuse beta-2 glycoprotein and beta-2 microglobulin. They sound very similar, but are two totally different things. Anti-beta-2 glycoprotein is the APLAS antibody. Beta-2 microglobulin is a prognostic marker in myeloma. And we sometimes see people accidentally ordering a beta-2 microglobulin when they mean to order a beta-2 glycoprotein antibody. And props for trying to diagnose this. But remember, with microglobulin, the M is for myeloma.
All right, so anticardiolipin and beta-2 glycoprotein are the two antibodies. What's the third test?
The last is the so-called lupus anticoagulant. And that one's actually not a specific antibody. It's referring to a whole group of antibodies that binds up phospholipids, and we collectively call them the lupus anticoagulant.
Why lupus?
Patients with lupus are at an increased risk of APLAS. But don't let the name fool you. There are plenty of APLAS patients who don't have lupus, so it's really not that great of a name.
Okay, but why the lupus anticoagulant?
Because this group of antiphospholipid antibodies will bind up all the phospholipids in your clotting assay, which prolongs the PTT, and makes it look like an anticoagulant. The irony is, these antibodies are actually procoagulant. That's the whole problem.
Jeez, that's a bit misleading. We're calling it the lupus anticoagulant. Maybe it really should be the lupus procoagulant.
Hematologists have been mad about the so-called lupus anticoagulant for a while now. One of our peer reviewers actually calls it the worst named thing in all of medicine. Anyway, don't be fooled by anticoagulant in the name or the long PTT. These patients clot.
Man, so last episode we talked about the hypercoagulability tests and which ones are affected by blood thinners. What if this patient is in the ED and was already started on a heparin drip? Can you still send off all three of those tests?
The only one that is impacted by being on blood thinners is the lupus anticoagulant. The test just works differently because it's a test for a whole group of antibodies. You might ask why, and it's kind of a long story, but the punchline is that it's a less direct test. And when you're on blood thinners, you can't really trust the result.
But at least I can send those two antibody tests, right? And if they're positive, they probably have APLAS?
Sadly, it's not that simple. The anticardiolipin and the anti-beta-2 glycoprotein tests have a pretty high false positive rate, so you have to repeat them 12 weeks later to confirm that they're still present, to confirm a diagnosis of APLAS.
Jeez, that's a tough 3 months while you're waiting to see if those antiphospholipid antibodies are false positives or not.
Exactly.
The presence of an antiphospholipid antibody does not mean that someone has antiphospholipid syndrome, okay? And so if you look, 5 to 10% of healthy blood donors walking around have the presence of an antiphospholipid antibody. They have never had a clot, and the vast majority are never going to go on to develop a clot. If you look at children and even teenagers and college students who get strep throat, they will have a positive anticardiolipin antibody that prolongs their PTT, but they do not usually develop thrombosis.
All right, that sure complicates things. So even 12 weeks out, the antibodies aren't cut and dry?
And that's sort of why this is a spectrum of risk. And the number of positive tests matters. Patients with all three tests being positive and confirmed 12 weeks later are in a whole different bucket of risk for clots. We call these patients triple positive.
The DOACs in people who turn out to be triple positive are inferior to warfarin therapy. So it has an implication both on long-term anticoagulation decisions, as well as the issue of potentially what anticoagulant you should use if you're triple positive.
Driving it home, the scary APLAS cases tend to be the triple positive ones. These are the ones who really need their warfarin.
We kind of want to identify up front someone who might be triple positive, and those are usually younger patients that come in with an arterial event that worry me the most. And even some older patients who don't have any of the traditional risk factors for stroke, thrombotic stroke. They don't have bad hypertension, dyslipidemia, diabetes, and obesity, and smoking. So if they're none of those things and they come in with a stroke and they don't have, you know, carotid atherosclerosis and they don't have anything else, I do think in many of those patients, it's worth checking to see if they're triple positive.
Okay, I'm getting that triple positive folks are the ones who tend to be more severely affected, but what if you aren't triple positive? Say it's just one or two antibodies. Should I be putting that patient on warfarin?
We don't know whether or not we could safely give a DOAC to patients that are single positive or double positive. There was a much smaller study done with rivaroxaban in the United Kingdom of 100 patients. None of them were triple positive. Most of them were single, persistently positive. They had no recurrent VTE events after a year.
Okay, so maybe we can get away with DOAC in the single positive folks.
I would also add that the arterial group are the ones that particularly did badly on a DOAC, more so than the people with VTE. So, you know, and these again were the triple positive, but I think in general, people have become very cautious, even in single positive APLS, about preferring warfarin, and certainly if they have arterial events.
The number of antibodies really matters, as does the clinical picture. Triple positive means warfarin for sure. Single or double positive? It's harder to say, though I think a lot of people will play it safe. And reminder, this does require confirmation 12 weeks later.
And I guess that begs the question, what do we do in the meantime? You know, say I'm admitting this patient, I'm thinking about APLAS and sending the antibodies, but we know the antibodies aren't going to come back for a couple of days. So do I start warfarin like ASAP just in case?
Really, that's in the hematologist's hands. Generally speaking, in a high-risk clot like a bad stroke, or if you find out your patient's triple positive, warfarin is probably the move. On the other hand, if it's a lower-risk clot and there are maybe one or two lower titer antibodies, they may not need warfarin right away. The upside is you generally have a second to think here and call on your friends. It's not like warfarin would be immediately therapeutic anyway.
So it's not like you have to start on day one because it is risk over time. I often see people 3 to 4 or 5 months after they've had their clot, and many of them are on a DOAC, and someone might have done the testing and they were positive, but by the time they got to me, you know, they were positive. And I laid out the data to some people, but then they have some things going on, right? Like I had one patient, his son was getting married and the timing just didn't work to transition to warfarin and make sure the INR was okay and test because they were traveling. And so we waited till the wedding was over.
Interesting. So maybe not every one of those patients needs warfarin right away.
Let's summarize this, Pearl, because APLAS pretty much breaks every rule we talked about before. APLAS testing really does change management in a big way. APLAS often presents as young patients with bad clots. These can be big arterial clots, strokes, recurrent pregnancy loss, really bad VTE. These might also be the triple positive patients, the ones you really want to catch and put on warfarin. Remember that triple positive here refers to the three tests that we can send. The two antibodies, anticardiolipin and anti-beta-2-glycoprotein, and one functional assay, the lupus anticoagulant. You should send all three of these early if you're going to test, but remember, only check the lupus anticoagulant if you can draw it before you start a blood thinner.
And to make a diagnosis, we need a repeat testing in 12 weeks. The key is consistent, high titer positivity over time. So if your initial test shows that your patient isn't triple positive, time is probably on your side. Of course, involve a hematologist if you're concerned enough to test. It helps to have an expert help you interpret all those results. All right, I think that's a wrap for Pearl 4 and the episode.
That's right. We covered a lot of ground this episode, so we're letting you all out of class early this time.
As always, thank you so much for joining us. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team and colleagues. Give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us. Tweet us and leave a comment on our website or on Instagram or on Facebook.
As always, we love your feedback. Email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Are we really treating them like unprovoked clots indefinitely? Can we ever de-escalate therapy? I'm going to re-record because my phone buzzed.
Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Marty Freed, general internist and the addiction... Sorry. All right. Gosh.